Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Amity.
And I'm Laura. Let's get started.
That reminds me, I'm following you, right? Like on our little paper that we have that tells us what to say. And today I play the piano for the choir. And like the beginning was a cappella. I lost where we were and I started playing too early. I was like,
no.
I'm such an idiot. I just played the first chord and I was like, oh, that wasn't right.
So that's not right.
Let's pretend like you guys didn't hear that.
That's really funny. I'm sorry. It's all right. It was nobody knows. For all they know, it was just a little note of inspiration in the middle of the a cappella.
Notice. I don't know, but I was like, you know how like the music is like when it's a cappella like that, it's like one line and then all of a sudden it's two. And I just like got flustered and messed it up.
Started. You were ready. Ready whether everybody else was or not.
Yeah, I was like, don't pretend like you didn't hear that. I need to play the piano more often so I don't get nervous, I guess. That was my music story for the day. This is a lot that we're going to cover today.
We've talked before about how we split it into sections of about 110 pages. Of course, that might depend on the book a little bit, but regardless, Jane Eyre is a very long book. So each of the sections that we're covering is about 110 pages. So it doesn't matter how many chapters it is. This section covers six chapters in 110 pages. And this is very small type.
Yeah.
Those are very long chapters. And remember, our very first episode was nine chapters. So
those are short.
So the chapters keep getting longer and longer. There's just a lot to them.
Doesn't it seem like when the chapters are longer, it just feels harder?
Yeah. So, well, I'm happy that I get to talk about this at the end, but I started reading a new book to my kids and we busted through like 30 pages, which when you're sitting down with kids, that's quite a few pages to go through. But the thing is, the chapters were so short. They'd be like a page, two or three pages, you know? And so it didn't feel like it was very long. 30 pages and something like 12 chapters, 13 chapters, something like that. I don't even know.
Sometimes you hear people say like, oh, I love books with short chapters. And I'm like, I get it. Because when they're long like this, you just kind of feel, it just makes it feel longer. But I mean, it's interesting. It's just long.
Yeah, so good.
Where we left off was Jane had went to back to Gateshead to see her aunt who was dying. And so that's where we left off. The aunt had told her about her father's brother who had like inquired about her and said he wanted to leave her some money. And it had been 3 years since she got the letter. So anyways, that's where we left off. So the aunt never really forgives her. Jane tries to be kind. It doesn't go well. So that's where we left her.
Yes. And she does. She tries to be kind, even though you're like, what in the world? Mrs. Reed like could have completely ruined her future. And that's what she was trying to do. Like, how do you forgive that? That's pretty rough. All right. So jumping into chapter 22, Jane talks about how like Mr. Rochester was like, hey, you can only be gone for me for like a week. But remember, the trip itself is, what was it, like 80-100 miles, something like that. And at that point in time, that was not an easy distance. That was a long way to travel. And so you don't just go for a couple of days, you go for a while. And she felt like there was so much to take care of, you know, a lot of emotions. She wanted to be there for the funeral and then, you know, see what she could do to kind of help Georgiana and Eliza sort of get settled and deal with things. That's just who she is. And so she ended up being gone for a month. At the end of the month, there is a little bit of resolution. And she talks about, she's like, I'm never going to talk about Georgiana and Eliza again. So I'll just tell you what happens. And I kind of love that because it's like, they are not worth taking up any more space in my brain. I'm done with them. It reminds me of C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity when he was like, love others as we love ourselves. And he just really means like, at least C.S. Lewis's interpretation was, we don't wish them badly. We may not be friends with them. We may not have anything to do with them ever again, but we don't wish them badly. And so I think that's what she's doing here. It was like, she didn't wish them badly, but she didn't want them to take up any more space in her brain. And so Eliza does She becomes a mother superior in a convent in France, I believe. Georgiana made an advantageous match with a wealthy, worn-out man of fashion. And so I'm guessing she married somebody who's much older. She kind of leaves them behind. They're going to be fine. And she makes her way back to Thornfield, and she's pretty excited to get there. She walks quite a bit of the way, and as she's coming along, she sees a man, and he's just reading. I wanted to share this part. She says, "I felt glad as the road shortened before me, so glad that I stopped once to ask myself what that joy meant and to remind reason that it was not to my home I was going, or to a permanent resting place, or to a place where fond friends looked out for me and waited my arrival. Mrs. Fairfax will smile you a calm and welcome, to be sure," said I, "and little Adele will clap her hands and jump to see you. But you know very well you are thinking of another than they, and that he is not thinking of you." So let me back up just a little bit. She does talk for a minute about this whole concept of going home and how, like, throughout her life, she'd never had that sensation before of being excited to go home, because Gateshead was not a home to her. She wouldn't have, and she'd never really gone home there until it was to go see Mrs. Reed Day. Lowood was not a home. You know, I mean, I think it became as comfortable as it possibly could be, but it was not, and like, she was never excited to return there if she ever had to leave. And so Thornfield, she's like telling herself, she's like, well, this isn't, it's not like people are going to be leaning out the window excited to see me, but she was happy to go back. And she realizes it's because of Mr. Rochester. Like, she loves Mrs. Fairfax. She loves Adele, but she's really excited to see Mr. Rochester. And she keeps telling herself, he's not even thinking of you. So stop being excited, but she can't help it.
So much of this book is her trying to convince herself that he doesn't love her.
Yes, totally. But then she sees Mr. Rochester is sitting on a narrow stile with stone steps, a book and a pencil in his hand. He is writing. And there he is. So he is there and he greets her. It's almost like she dreamed him there. Have you ever like been going along through your life and been like, oh, it would be really cool if this thing happened like right now? I don't think it could happen, but it'd be really cool if it did. But for her, it did happen. He was there. He was the one who greeted her as she returned to Thornfield. And I guarantee that if Jane Eyre was a real person, that is a fantasy that would have been happening in her head.
And I haven't ever been that successful, except one time.
Oh, let's hear it.
We were in the car. I might have told this story already. We're in the car. It's snowing. We were very poor and didn't want to pay car payments on our car anymore. And I said to David, this would be a really good day to get hit. And we got hit like about a minute later.
Oh, that's okay.
So yes, that one time.
Oh, that's not good.
It was good. It paid off our car and we got to keep it. And it just had a little dent.
Okay. Well, you're right. Okay.
But I mean, it wasn't good. We got hit.
It'd be really scary. You'd be shaken. But you're right. Like, I guess
yeah.
If it had to happen, it was the ideal time, ideal situation. And you guys apparently did not get hurt or anything.
No, not at all. But it was so funny. I said, this would be a good day to get hit. Boom.
That is so, you need to try that again sometime.
I mean, that's the only, I can't think of another time, but wouldn't that be great if we could like dream up things and then they would.
Oh my gosh. Yes. That would be amazing. He just greets her and she tells him that her aunt has passed away. Excuse me. She knows that he's been in London. Basically what comes out, and he's like, yeah, I've got this carriage. You come tell me if you think that it's going to be fitting of the next Mrs. Rochester. And so basically Jane has been having communication with Mrs. Fairfax, and they think, well, she thinks, and he allows her to believe that he's going to marry Miss Ingram. And he's been to London and back and all these things. Jane is pretty sure that's what's going to happen. And she's trying to resign herself to that. It's very difficult, though. Like, you can like, her heart is like ripped to shreds. But she's like, but also, I almost don't have any right to be sad, because of course he's going to choose her. And of course, he's like a million places removed from my station. And there's just no way. So I just have to be satisfied with it. But she's so sad.
Yes. How many times in life does that happen to poor girls?
Oh my gosh. Right.
They're so sad.
So sad. So like, yeah. How do we handle it? All the heartbreak. Stupid boys.
I just watch my girls and I'm like, oh, you poor things. You just, it's sad.
Yeah.
Especially when one of them has a really big crush on somebody, and I don't know. It's just sad to watch.
I know.
Love is a big problem in our lives.
Oh my gosh, it is. It is.
And you know what's funny though is like my daughter Katie right now is kind of living what I lived. Her boyfriend right now, she had a huge crush on him, like as in mm-hmm. high school. So it's just kind of funny. It's like, oh well, she's kind of living what I've lived. And then I have another daughter who could care less about anybody.
My kids are kind of just all over the map that way.
So our third daughter, it's like, I would love to be like that, to just not care.
Seriously.
About, like anything or anybody.
Just lock up your heart.
Just maybe to not need to be loved or something like that. I don't know. Like, I know. She needs to be loved by us, but like other
yes,
people, she could care
we
about.
Have that need. Absolutely. It's a basic need, but not to feel like any of your worth.
Yes.
Or any of your fulfillment comes from the love of a man, to just be whole without it. Because honestly, that's probably the best way to approach a relationship anyway, to be completely whole.
You know, you're right.
Can any of us do that? I don't know.
But maybe that's like the goal as parents, to somehow teach our children that they don't need anybody to make them whole. I don't know.
Yeah.
How do you do that? Because I think in our life, we are in our culture, we think that's how we live, is that to be whole, you have to have a partner.
And it's hard because we're such social creatures. And so we think we do need people to be whole. But at the same time, we have far better relationships if we ourselves are healed and whole. And we still need people, but we don't need them to fill anything
right
in us. We just need the social aspect. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah. But so how do we teach our kids that? Or how do we like build them up enough so that they feel that? Interesting. Somebody should write a book about it.
I will start. I'll do some research, man.
I have to write a research paper for my writing class. Maybe I'll pick something about that.
We should co-write a book about being whole before you enter into a relationship, any kind of relationship. And how do you do that?
Okay. We're on
it. I like it. Oh, one last thing I will mention really quickly. This is probably the shortest chapter, and yet I've taken so long on it. I'm sorry. One thing she observed, you know, she expects she's going to get there. He's like all engaged to Miss Ingram, she assumes. And so she also assumes he's just going to be like at Ingram Hall all the time, always leaving. He never leaves. In fact, he's like always calling Jane to come hang out with him and sit and chat with him and all this stuff. And she's completely baffled. Because on the one hand, she believes that one thing is true, but she's seeing something very different. And so it's, so that messes with your heart and your mind too.
Well, he messes with her.
So bad. I know. That is the one thing that I'm like, dude, I don't know. Kind of love him, kind of hate him.
It's very hard to read this book without the lens of 2024. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Because you read it and you're like, okay, toxic dude, red flags all over the place.
But yeah, but how much of it was like that was normal?
Yeah. But for the time period, this is completely different. Yeah.
Yeah. So chapter 23, this one was pretty long. One evening after Del goes to bed, Jane goes out to the garden for a walk and she smells a cigar and she's like, immediately knows that's Mr. Rochester. She's like, I know that smell. And I know he's around here. So she tries to hide in the ivy, hoping that if she holds still enough, then he's not going to see her. And she's like, oh, he won't stay here very long, so I'll be fine. But he stops and looks at everything. And he's like looking up and looking down and like looking at the bugs and the leaves and the flowers. So at one point he's got his back turned to her, and so she decides she's going to try to slip away, and so she does. She tries to go, and he, without looking at her, says, Jane, come and look at this fellow. Like, he knew she was there the whole time. She's like, how did he see me? She hadn't made any noise, and she doesn't know how he knew she was there, but now she's caught and she's stuck. So he invites her to go walk with him, and she doesn't know what to say, so she just says, okay. As they walk, she is very uncomfortable, but he seems totally at ease, which I think is kind of funny because he's like the master. He's in charge. He's comfortable, and she's like a nervous wreck. Isn't that interesting? So does that tell you about his self-esteem, his comfort with who he is, and then she is kind of the opposite, I guess.
Oh yeah. Which is really interesting because there's so many arenas where she is very calm and collected. Like, she seems to be very calm and collected for the most part. But I think that he is. I think he's extremely confident.
Which ego. Is funny because of his past, he shouldn't be.
That's what I'm saying.
It's because he's male. All of our male listeners, you know, like husbands, they're going to stop listening to us after this. Be like, no. So Mr. Rochester, this is what I think is awful. He's messing with her. Tells her that he's finally decided he's going to marry Blanche Ingram. And that he knows of this available position for Jane to go to in Ireland. Mm-hmm. She's worried about Ireland being so far away from Thornfield. But really, she's afraid of it being away from him.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of accidentally blurts that out. And then starts to sob, right? She's crying. So they sit on a bench by this chestnut tree, and he says this, which I think is really funny. Sometimes I have a queer feeling with regard to you, especially when you are near to me, as now. He says it feels like there's a string that connects them, and if she leaves, then that cord of communion will be snapped. And he's worried that he will bleed inwardly, which he's just, right, going to be sad.
Mm-hmm.
But she'll just forget him.
The way he describes where the string is, it's attached to his heart.
Yes.
You know? Like, okay, dude.
The cord of communion.
Yeah.
Will be snapped. Jane says, for I could repress what I endured no longer. And so she tells the reader, I was obliged to yield. And I love how she'll, like, turn to the reader. Like, she's...
Mm-hmm. I like that, too.
Yeah. Like, hey, I'm going to tell you, you know, this is, might be what I said, or I didn't say anything, but this is what I was thinking. And, you know, she does this a couple times. They have this strange conversation where she basically says, if you're going to be married to Miss Ingram, I'm going to have to go. And he argues that she has to stay. She says, I tell you, I must go. Do you think I can stay to become nothing to you? Do you think I'm an automaton? And then she says, a machine without feelings? Do you think because I am poor, obscure, plain, and little, I am soulless and heartless? You think wrong. She's like, I'm not talking to you like master and servant. I'm talking to you spirit to spirit here. Like, we're on the same plane. Just as if both had passed through the grave and we stood at God's feet, equal as we are.
Which I really love, because I think that sort of perspective is something that not very many people had at that time. Because a lot of times their idea was that even in God's eyes, people that are high born are better than people that are low born. Like, they literally thought that a king was divinely appointed. So for her to say, I don't care about our stations here, I'm talking to you as if we were before God, she is acknowledging that before God, they are equal. They're just restrained by these stupid rules and customs on earth that are pretty groundless.
Where they happen to be born.
Where they happen to be born, who they happen to be born to, what their lot in life happens to be, which is just totally luck of the draw. Doesn't mean anything about them.
Yeah, she says, equal as we are. And then Mr. Rochester repeats, as we are. It says that he pulls her in and puts his lips to hers.
I know. It just, like, mentions it, and then they keep talking. I'm like, wait, wait, don't.
Did they kiss? Because it sounded like they couldn't kiss until they were engaged. Like, later on, she says that Mrs. Rochester, or not Mrs. Rochester, Mrs. Fairfax had seen them kiss, but she didn't know they were engaged. So it was actually okay, even though she thought it wasn't. But it's like, okay, but it's not clearly he was going to marry somebody else.
I'm pretty sure they kissed. He is not the kind of person who cares that much about convention. And it does say he put his lips to hers and drew her in. So yes, they kissed.
Okay.
Definitely. I was just going, okay, shouldn't we, like, stop and talk about that for a second? I mean, they just keep talking like nothing happened. Like, I mean, okay, carry on as you were.
I know. Think about, like, when you do have a first kiss, I mean, especially somebody like Jane would be like, whoop.
Like, it's her first kiss. Oh, you would think it'd be a big deal.
Yeah. And it just, like, goes on. Like, brush. Okay. They kiss.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's like, let me go. You're a married man. Well, almost a married man is what she says. To someone I don't think you love. She tells him that now But she has said what was in her mind. Like, I've told you how I feel, now I can leave. That's when Mr. Rochester surprises her when he asks her to marry him. And she thinks that he's joking or teasing her or whatever. But then he eventually convinces her that he is not. And he admits that he had only brought up marrying Blanche to make her jealous. What a jerk. He says, "What love have I for Miss Ingram? None, that you know. What love has she for me? None, as I have taken pains to prove." Now, this he had done when he dressed up as the gypsy. And maybe he was testing her at that point.
It totally was. Yeah.
Yes. Maybe she was an option at that point. And then he's like, okay, she only wants me for my money. So good, because I want this lady.
Yeah.
So this convinces her, and then she accepts his proposal. So a storm breaks. They hurry inside, running through the rain. And Mr. Rochester helps Jane out of her coat. And then he kisses her again. And Jane looks up and sees, this is where she sees Mrs. Fairfax watching. And Mrs. Fairfax looks shocked.
Mm-hmm.
So the next morning, Adele comes running in to tell Jane that a bolt of lightning had split that chestnut tree that they had been sitting by the night before. So that's it.
Any sort of foreshadowing or...
Yeah, I wonder.
Horrifying symbolism. Yes, there is.
Okay. I figured. I know what happens in the section we're covering today, but I don't know what happens after that.
Oh, I mean, I think it's mostly just this
today. Okay. We won't do any spoilers in case people are listening to us in segments.
Exactly. Okay. So the next morning she wakes up and she's kind of going, so was that real? Did that actually happen? And she's like, I can't be sure until I see Mr. Rochester again. But when she does see him again, he like pulls her in. He's like kissing her just all over. And yes, it's totally real. They're very much engaged. She's like, we need to be married in like 4 weeks, no less. She's like, okay. Apparently he had called for his jewels. Like he'd kept the family jewels at his bank or something. So he's like, I've ordered the jewels to be brought for you. And she's like, no, I don't want those. That's not who I am. She's like, don't address me as if I were a beauty. I am your plain Quakerish governess. And just, I mean, just the thing is, that's not why she wants him. And I think he's probably gotten so used to people wanting him and liking him for his money that he kind of thinks that that's all he has to offer. I think that he knows that Jane really does love him, but that's sort of his fallback. That's his default mode. I'm going to shower you with money because that's what I do have to offer. I'm not handsome, not like this charmer or something, but I do have lots of money. And she's like, no, that's not what I want at all. I think that's kind of baffling to him. So he wants to take her to Millcote and have her choose some dresses. And she agrees, but she doesn't want them to be too crazy or something. She wants Adele to go with them. Yeah, because she likes Adele and she's not Blanche Ingram. She's not any of the people that he has dated, courted before, or whatever, had as mistresses, as we'll find out. He does ask her, he's like, ask me for something. Tell me what you want. And she's like, okay, well, I don't want the jewels. What does she ask for?
She's worried that he's like trying to dress her up as a plaything.
Well, yes. She does want to ask him a question. This is what she wants. Why did you take such pains to make me believe you wished to marry Miss Ingram? Okay, so here it is. It's like
good question.
It is a good question, and she totally deserves an answer. And he says, I feigned courtship of Miss Ingram because I wished to render you as madly in love with me as I was with you. And I knew jealousy would be the best ally I could call in for the furtherance of that end. I mean, okay, to be fair, like we've all done it, right? Like we've all tried to do the jealousy thing a little bit. But it seems to be a little bit extreme, especially since he's messing with the heart of a governess, a very young girl. So it seems pretty lame to me, but I just don't know that he knew any other way. And so that's what he did. He was trying to make her jealous. It kind of worked, but not really. She loved him anyway, so it didn't really matter. I think it probably just made her irritated more than anything and was like, okay, well, that's what he's gonna do, so I just have to be resigned to it. So I think it didn't actually work at all. Instead, he just wasted his time. But he did find out. He's like, they found out that I had like a third. I let them believe that I had like a third of the fortune they thought I had. And then Miss Ingram and her mother both were very cold to me. So after this little back and forth with, what's his name, Mr. Rochester, she does have a talk with Mrs. Fairfax. Mrs. Fairfax is like, so Mr. Rochester, she's like, I'm still kind of reeling because Mr. Rochester, I could swear that he just told me that you guys are getting married in a month, but I don't think that can possibly be true. And Jane's like, so it is. She kind of reminds her of her station and everything. One thing Mrs. Fairfax says is like, she is concerned about the fact that they're not equal in position or fortune. And she's like, and also he's like 20 years older than you. Like he could be your father. And I think a lot of this is not so much a chastisement to Jane as like a warning. This could be a very difficult position for a young girl. You don't have fortune. You don't have family. You don't have position. And you're like 20 years younger than him. This might not be a good situation for you. So I don't think that she's really getting after her. I do think that she's trying to warn her. And I think Jane probably takes that into consideration, but she's like, is it really for love he's going to marry you? She is pretty skeptical, but I think she gets to where she accepts it.
How would you feel if you were in love with somebody and they were going to marry you and people were like, I don't think he loves you. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That would just be, you know, she's telling herself the whole time, like, how dare you think he loves you? You're not good enough.
Yeah.
You don't have enough money. You're not in the right station, you know, whatever. That woman is so much better than you. And then you've got other people telling you that too. I just think that's
yeah, girl. To sort of like validate everything that, like all of your worst fears.
Yes.
Kind of awful. For yeah. Sure. Yeah, no, it'd be horrible. It's like, worst nightmare.
Thanks, Mrs. Fairfax.
Okay, so they go shopping. He wants to buy her all this crazy stuff, and she settles for things that are still pretty, but not so garish or outlandish. He just thinks that that is the way to do it, and she's like, no, I'm good with pearl gray silk and black satin, which is still going to be beautiful and very nice. Good grief, it's silk and satin, but she doesn't want, like I said, all these just outlandish and garish colors. Something that she says I think was really important. She says, do you remember what you said of Céline Varens, of the diamonds, the cashmeres you gave her? I will not be your English Céline. I shall continue to act as Adele's governess. By that, I shall earn my board and lodging and £30 a year besides. I'll furnish my own wardrobe out of that money, and you shall give me nothing but your regard. And if I give you mine in return, that debt will be quit. But her whole purpose behind that, I feel like there was a part where she really explained it really well. I'm sure she did. I'm just not seeing it right now. She's like, I'm not going to be that woman part two. And what she'll find out later is it would be like part four. Because he did have quite a few mistresses and stuff. And she's like, that's not who I am. And that's not what you need. It's not what I need. And we're just not going there. I'm just going to end this chapter with this last part right here. So my future husband was becoming to me my whole world and more than the world, almost my hope of heaven. He stood between me and every thought of religion as an eclipse intervenes between man and the broad sun. I could not in those days see God for his creature, of whom I had made an idol. And I kind of love that just because, of course, nobody should replace God. And I don't think that's what she's saying. But for her, she was not just smitten, but she loved him so much. She did kind of idolize him in a lot of ways, maybe too much. But also, shouldn't every woman be able to feel that about her man?
Yeah.
Maybe that's too big of an ideal, but I'm going with it.
I hate to be like annoying, but like that's how I was. My mom would say to me things like, I can't believe how you look at him and laugh at him.
You know, I love that so much though.
Like yeah. Other people could see it. My sister said the other day, who knows what we were talking about, but she said, I think all of us, so I have two sisters and we're all mm-hmm. three married now. We all idolize our husbands. Like we think they're just, we probably think they're better than other people. If that makes sense.
I think that is incredible though.
But it's just funny because we do, all three of us do. We all love our husbands and think they're like the most incredible thing that ever walked on the planet.
I love
I
it.
see.
That is amazing.
Sorry, I'm making you all sick, but it's just.
No, why would that make anybody sick?
I don't
That
know.
is it's incredible.
But yeah, my mom used to say that to me. Like, I can tell how much you love him because of how you idolize him and look at him and laugh at him. And, you know,
Yeah.
it's funny.
I love
Like,
that.
she's probably like, whatever he said was not that funny. And I do not understand. So hard. Or I don't know, you know, I don't get it. So I'll cut
Think
that out.
that's so cool. No, don't cut that out at all. I think that's amazing. It gives everybody a little bit of hope, like that
Well, I
can
mean,
happen.
not that we're not all without our problems, but
Of
like
course.
in the end, like we do idolize
Yeah.
them. We
It all
learned it by
comes down.
watching our mother. I don't know. Just made that up.
Was gonna say, did you? That's awesome.
Possibly, because you know what? My brother idolizes his wife. Yeah, he loves her like we love our husband. So maybe it is something we learned as a young
Maybe
kid.
so.
This is the mark of a good classic. There's
That's
so much
so
to talk
much to
about.
talk about. Yep. And I feel like we are just scratching the surface,
I
but we would be talking, we could talk about Jane Eyre all year long. But the nice thing about all these classics, you could talk about all of them all year long. Another mark of a good classic.
There's so
So,
much to talk about.
yeah.
Okay, so chapter 25. It's the night before the wedding, and Jane is waiting for Mr. Rochester, who has been out for the evening. So I think Adele had gone to sleep early. I think this is the chapter where she'd gone to sleep early. And so she takes a walk out in the orchard where she sees the chestnut tree that had split in the storm a while back. So you're right, because this is the night before the wedding. This is the foreshadowing reminder about the chestnut tree. She's so restless that she can't sit in the house. And even though it's stormy, she goes out. She's like, if I go out and meet him, then I'm going to see him sooner. Because he's coming in, right? So she kind of walks out to meet him and he sees her. And so he helps her back up on the, or he helps her up on the horse and they ride the horse back to Thornfield together. When they get in, he tells her, like, they get into the house, he's like, go quick and change out of your wet clothes and then come meet me in the library. So when she gets to the library, she sits down and tells him that she cannot eat. He asks if it's because she's worried about they're going to go on a trip to London. After they must be going on a trip to London, because
Well, yeah, probably. Yeah.
are
Like
you
for
worried
their
about him?
honeymoon. Yeah.
Yes. And she says, I cannot see my prospects clearly tonight, sir, and I hardly know what thoughts I have in my head. Everything in life seems unreal. And he says, except me, I'm substantial enough. Touch me. She's like, you're the most phantom-like of all. You're a mere dream. I mean, have you ever felt like that? Like, say the night before your wedding, which is what they're doing. Like, this doesn't seem real. Like, is this actually happening tomorrow? In your mind, you never think it's gonna come, something, right? Whatever it is.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So yeah, she's like, you're the most phantom-like of all. They finish eating, but he wants her to stay with him, and he can tell that something is wrong, and he keeps pressing her to tell him what it is. It's something big. So
Yeah.
the night before, Jane's wedding dress had arrived, and underneath it was this really expensive veil that had been his wedding gift to her. And, you know, of course, she's like, with everything he gives her, she's like, no.
This
Like,
is too much.
yeah, that's not for me. So in the night, Jane had had a strange dream, and there was a little child that was crying, and she was carrying it in her arms as she tried to reach Mr. Rochester, who was ahead of her on this like long and windy road. And the more she moved toward him, the further it seems like he's getting away from her. This is not a good omen. She tells him about her second dream that she'd had that night. And in this one, Thornfield is in ruins. And she's stumbling around, she's wrapped in a shawl, and she's still carrying this same child. And she can't lay her down anywhere. Like, there's nowhere for her to put her. And the kid is getting heavy and her arms are getting tired. So that's when she hears a horse and she thinks that it's Mr. Rochester leaving. And he, in her mind, he's like leaving for a really long time. And so she climbs this stone wall so she can look over and see him going away. She wants to see him one more time before he leaves. And so she climbs this stone wall. The child is clinging to her. The wind is blowing, and as she turns to look at him one more time, The wall she's sitting on crumbles and the child like rolls off of her lap. These are awful dreams. So the dream was so disturbing that it wakes her up and she notices that there's a rustling in her closet.
Terrifying.
Yes. And she knows that it's nobody that she knows from the house. That it's somebody else. It's not even Grace Poole. It's this poor woman that they blame everything on.
I know. You can't help but like feel bad for Grace Poole.
But she makes a lot of money.
She makes a lot of money. Good for her, as she should, because she gets blamed for literally everything.
Yes. And he's like, she tells him like it wasn't anybody from the house. And he's like, oh, it had to be one of them. He's always trying to convince her. No, it was nothing. So she describes the lady to him and she says it was a woman, tall and large, with thick and dark hair hanging long down her back. She was wearing something white, but she couldn't tell exactly what. And the woman had taken Jane's veil and put it on her head. And that's when Jane could see her face in the mirror. And she was scary looking, discolored, disturbing. So then the lady takes the veil off and tears it up into two pieces and throws it on the floor and tramples it. And then she leaves. This is the worst. As she's leaving, she comes up to Jane with the candle and gets right in her face. And she says she extinguished it under her eyes. And Jane passes out because she's so scared.
She's so scared. And this is she mentions this is the second time in her life that she's passed out from absolute fear. And the first time, if you remember, was when she was shut in the red room and she thought she saw a ghost. And yeah. This time she also thinks she sees a ghost.
Yes.
Absolutely terrifying.
She passes out because she's so scared, as she should be.
I know. Because the first time there was not an actual ghost, not anything actually terrifying. It was just a light. It was all wonky. This time there's a person in there who actually like could take her life and has tried to do very similar things to other people. So
yes,
would not be beyond.
So Rochester tells her that the woman must have been Grace Poole and that what she'd experienced was actually half dream, half reality. And he tells her that eventually I will explain everything after we've been married for 1 year and one day.
Hey, that's not a red flag. Jeez.
No. Then he like convinces her to sleep with Adele that night. And she goes in to sleep with Adele and she's just crying because she's eventually going to have to leave Adele if she marries him. What a chapter.
So 26, it's the day of the wedding. Jane gets all dressed. She's so excited. They head to the church. There's not very many people there. In fact, there's only like two people there and they're kind of hiding out in the corner. She's like, okay, this is weird. But so they go up to the clergyman and he starts in on just the, you know, the normal stuff. Like if there's any reason why these two should not be joined in matrimony, speak now or forever hold your peace. Right. And Jane's like, nobody ever really responds to that. It just has to be said. And then he starts to carry on. But then all of a sudden there's this voice that says, I can't let this marriage carry on. And I think she probably didn't think that that was real for a little bit. Neither did Mr. Rochester. Mr. Rochester is like, carry on, basically ignore this. Well, it turns out that the person who said that is a Mr. Briggs. He's an attorney. Mr. Briggs is like, no, Mr. Rochester cannot get married because he is already married. He already has a wife. Just put yourself in Jane's shoes for like half a second. Every emotion is probably washing over her. She's like feeling probably completely floored, shocked, disbelief, anger, sadness, all the things. Mr. Rochester is already married. And he denies it immediately. He's like, no, I'm not. I'm not married. And Mr. Briggs is like, yeah, you are.
Not
and
married.
I've got the receipts.
I'm not married here.
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Briggs is like, yes, you were married to a Bertha Mason in Jamaica 15 years ago. So Mr. Mason, and you remember him from the last episode, he had showed up. He was attacked by quote unquote Grace Poole. And it looked like she bit him and he left in a flood of blood. Remember, Jane sat up with him like all night to make sure he didn't bleed out. And he was sent back to Jamaica or somewhere. And I'm pretty sure Mr. Rochester did not think that he was going to hear from him again. Well, he shows up And he stops the wedding. He's like, you are married to my sister, and it's my obligation to stop this wedding because you cannot marry this young girl under the pretense that you are not already tied up because you are to my sister. So Mr. Rochester is very angry. He grabs Jane and he grabs Mr. Briggs, Mr. Macy. He's like, okay, come see what it is that I'm married to. And so they go back to Thornfield and they go up to this room. They open it up and there's Grace Poole at the fireplace cooking some sort of a dish. Mr. Rochester is like, how are things today? And Grace Poole says, things are okay. She's, you know, she's all right. Not like, not horrible. And there is this person back in the corner of the room. She describes her as being like a large woman in build. She's quite tall. She's very dark complected and she's big. I think she's probably put on a lot of weight. She's crazy. Like she sees Mr. Rochester and she attacks him. And he has to grab ropes and tie her up to a chair. She's trying to like kill him. And he's like, yeah, this is what I'm married to. This is my wife, Bertha. Which, okay, I'm sorry. I just, Bertha, it's like, it might be one of the worst names. I'm sorry.
I'm sure nobody alive today is named Bertha.
I truly hope not for their sake. But anyways, her name was Bertha.
Yeah, just told like to me that sounds like a large woman.
It totally does. Bertha with a wide girth. As you can imagine, Jane is completely desolated. Like she's going, okay, what now? She describes suddenly feeling like it's, she says, a Christmas frost had come at midsummer. A white December storm had whirled over June. Ice glazed the ripe apples. Drifts crushed the blowing roses. On hayfield and cornfield lay a frozen. She literally goes on for like this huge paragraph talking about how like everything that was once good and warm and happy and beautiful is now just like destroyed by a winter frost. And she's so sad. And she's like, I was so blind. How did I not see? And it's like, how are you supposed to see? Because it turns out, and we'll talk about this later, but like Mr. Rochester had told them to not tell Jane about this person living in his house.
Yeah.
And so this is something we talked about before. Like, how did she not know? Well, everybody in his house knew, but he had instructed them to not tell the new governess about Bertha.
About his wife, no.
Yeah. So she is... She's so sad. And that's where the chapter ends.
I know. Can you imagine? I used to have dreams before I got married that like I was getting married and the person was like, for one reason or another, not suitable.
Okay.
Really, really short. Not that that's like not suitable, right? But
in, but dreams, in your eyes,
it was not suitable.
Fair or enough.
Like, I mean, I hate to say this, but like, and I don't mean by not suitable, but like, turns out it was a woman. I don't know how to explain it, but like, yeah. I would have these dreams where I was getting married and I was super excited. And then all of a sudden I realized this wasn't going to work. They're married to somebody else. It was like my worst nightmare.
Jane lived that nightmare.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm having these dreams in the 90s. Okay. So I'm just saying the times were different then. And
yes,
in my mind as a teenager, some things were not okay.
Yes.
I have, my minds have been changed, but... Okay, so chapter 27. Now, this is a funny story. In my book, chapter 27 is labeled with 24.
What? Oh, really?
Is that not the weirdest thing ever?
That is weird. It goes
chapter 24, 25, 26, 24.
24. Oh, that's not confusing at all.
No, I was super confused.
Yeah. How did they even mess that up? Jeez.
I don't know.
The editor should be fired.
Jane has been sleeping for a while. And she wakes up and realizes that she has to leave Thornfield. Like, this just isn't going to work. She gets up to come out of her room. Oh, and she also realizes that nobody's come to check on her. This happened. She's upset. She's in her room. Like, she's closed herself off in a room. And nobody has come. Yeah. Which is disturbing. But
disturbing and sad because this is like a major traumatic event and she realizes there's so many things that she's dealt with by herself and she does not want to deal with this by herself.
So she does get up to come out of the room and she finds that Mr. Rochester is waiting there in a chair. So he just like promises her that he never meant to hurt her and he asks her for forgiveness. And Jane doesn't say anything back. She's silent. But she does tell the reader, I forgave him right then. He's so sweet.
I know.
She can't say anything, but she forgives him. So Jane then starts to feel faint. And so Mr. Rochester carries her down to the library. And he says, like, I should never have brought you here. Knowing what was here, how did he ever think that he could hide his wife from her? You know what I mean? Like, this was never going to work. Obviously, it didn't. He says he should have put his wife in another house. Like, he owns these other houses. He's like, I could have put Grace Poole and her son over here at this other house and paid her more, kept her happy. Everything would have been fine.
Well, I think it was interesting, too, because he even says, he's like, if I had kept her at one of these other houses, she probably would have passed away, honestly. Because you, like, because they were, like, damp and chill, and she probably would have died.
Yeah, from mold.
Yeah.
The mold would have killed her. Which is funny because at the moment, David and I are like obsessed with the Chad Daybell trial and it's going on right now. Yeah. And like last week and probably this week too, they're talking about how he killed his wife. And it's just so fascinating because it's like, why didn't he just divorce her? And he's trying to convince everybody after she dies that she was sick. She didn't like to go to the doctor. She was having trouble breathing and you know, she was really sick and that's why she died. In her sleep, randomly. And everybody around her is like, no, she was perfectly healthy. Mm. 3 days before she died, before she was killed, she told somebody she felt the best she'd ever felt in her life. I don't know. It just made me.
He's like trying to convince himself. And no, then everybody else.
Well, he killed her. And then he's like, I got to tell everybody else that she was sick. Because
well, yeah. Yeah.
It's insane. And so. Our joke in our marriage is, if you ever want out, I'll let you go. Don't kill me.
Yeah, seriously. Seriously.
I will let you go. And then like this week, what's been bothering me about the trial, and it has never hit me before. Last year, we watched his other wife be on trial. But this week, it was like he took away all of his children's mother. How selfish.
Yeah.
Did not just divorce her. He killed her. And they've been talking about how close the kids were to their mom. It's like, why did you have to do that?
I don't think somebody that is that crazy can give a rational answer. But like, what was his reasoning for just not divorcing her?
Because he would have. That was bad. He was having an affair with this other woman. And he killed the other woman's two children. And he killed his wife. But getting divorced would have been bad.
That would have been bad.
Yeah.
Murder, on the other hand,
is like okay.
Three times over. Okay, that's what I was thinking, because it was like her two kids also that they like found buried in her backyard, which, oh my gosh, like
we honestly do not know how everybody on the planet is not watching this trial, because it is so interesting.
So crazy.
Anyways, I gotta go on, or I'll talk about this forever. Okay. It's so good. So I love that he says that Grace Poole will kind of do anything for money. And so she could have stayed with her in another house. So then he suggests that why don't they leave England, go to the south of France, and they can be together. They can live as husband and wife. And she's like, no matter how we look at this situation, as long as Bertha is still alive, I can only be your mistress. Like, I'm never going to be your wife. Then Mr. Rochester realizes that he needs to explain why he doesn't consider himself married to her. And so he tells her this whole long story about his past. So we learned earlier that Mr. Rochester's father didn't want to divide his property. So he gave it all to the older brother. But he also was like embarrassed to have a son that was like destitute. So he arranged to have Mr. Rochester go to Jamaica to marry Bertha, who was going to eventually inherit a fortune of £30,000. Now, I'm not smart enough to look this up, but my husband looked it up for me. That's the equivalent of $5.7 million today. So there's a lot of calculations involved in that. I was like, can you figure this out for me?
Yeah.
So that's quite an inheritance. Like,
it is.
If you're at $5.7 million, you're good for the rest of your life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that was just what she would bring to the table.
His wife was beautiful. And even though they hadn't spent very much time alone together, he kind of says, I was young and dumb. and I believed that I was in love, and so I agreed to marry her. Well, shortly after the wedding, he learns that her mother isn't dead, like he was told. She's actually in an insane asylum. So her younger brother was also what they called a mute idiot. So like in her family, there's this genetic thing where they go crazy. Mr. Rochester's father and brother had known all of this, but they thought that the money was more important and that he could deal with it. Encouraged the marriage anyways. Soon after they get married, Bertha starts like having these violent outbreaks. She's, I don't know, what else? Do you know what else it said? She has a temper.
Well, yeah. And then he talks about how he realized that she has like a pygmy brain. She's dumb. Kind of just animalistic in every sense of the word, even to where like her ability to function and to resolve problems and all these things. She does not have a well-functioning brain at all, obviously, but she's just not even smart.
Well, clearly he didn't spend any time with her then.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he talks about how like it was like she'd been really dressed up for parties and so she looked very beautiful and stuff, but he'd never been able to spend any time with her alone.
Which they probably did on purpose.
Of course they did. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Everybody knew. He finds out later that everybody knew. Like even his dad and brother knew, which would seem like the ultimate betrayal, I think. Yeah, so she's crazy. They all know she's crazy. It also talks about how she has a propensity for vices, like drinking. Yes. So, yeah, she just has a very small and weak mind.
So eventually she goes completely mad. Clearly, we've seen it in the book. So by this time, Mr. Rochester's father and his brother had died. And so he finds himself all alone with an insane wife and a lot of money. So he considers killing himself. But instead, he decides to go back to England. And he decides to put his wife at Thornfield Hall in safety and comfort to shelter her degradation with secrecy and leave her. That's his plan. But he kind of goes all over the world, like from city to city, looking for somebody to love. He had this idea of like a perfect woman and he like is searching for her and he can't find it. He says he's disappointed. And so he's like sleeping with everybody. And he's always disappointed with these women that he's with. What's her name was one of them, the French dancer,
the mother of Adele.
Yes, she was one of them. And then there was another lady named Clara that they mentioned. Then he met Jane. And so in part of this chapter, he kind of retells the story of meeting her from his point of view, which is interesting that you say that like Bertha was so unintelligent because that's what he really likes about Jane is her mind and her like her intelligence. And so Jane now feels torn. She doesn't want to, I mean, Rochester has had this horrible life. And so she doesn't want to like contribute to it, make it worse. She feels bad because he does love her and he's in a horrible situation. What's he going to do? She kind of has this voice within her that says, who in the world cares for you? And she wonders how she's ever going to find a man who is going to love her like Mr. Rochester does. How she should leave the only man that loves her. How can I leave this? Then on the other hand, her conscience tells her, like, I'm not going to have any self-respect if I don't leave him. Like, I have to do what I feel is right. So she tells him that she has to go. But she kisses his cheek and kind of prays for him. Like, prays that God will bless him as she leaves. And then that night, she has a dream that her mother comes to her and tells her to, like, get away from the temptation of him. And so she kind of sneaks down the stairs and sneaks out and leaves.
Yeah.
That's where we end.
It is interesting. And, you know, and he talks about how he kind of almost has this conversation with God and he gets to this point where he's like, no, like I'm not really married. Yeah. I have this responsibility, but I'm not really married. So it's fine if I get remarried or married to somebody that I actually want. He had gone through all the steps of completely justifying this. And you can't blame him, but he also can't deny reality. That's when you're like, okay, I wish that divorce was a lot easier to access at that point in time. But maybe he didn't feel like he could do that either. I don't know.
I was gonna say what was divorce?
Because it certainly was a thing. So I don't know why.
But would he have lost the money if he'd have divorced her?
No, but I mean, maybe hers, but he had all of his family money. He was fine that way. So I don't think he was worried about that at all.
Right.
And at that point, I don't think he would have cared anyway and be like, whatever.
I guess at least he didn't kill her.
Right? Yeah. I know. See, he's not a bad guy.
No.
But,
or left her out in the wilderness to, I don't know. He was taking care of her.
Even he totally could have put her in one of those other houses and she probably would have died from like asbestos or something crazy like that. But like,
why didn't he put her in an insane asylum?
Or put her in an insane asylum. I think because he didn't want anybody to know. Like, okay. Nobody in the neighborhood knew. It was just the few people that worked in his house. And there weren't that many people that worked in his house. And it sounds like they were sworn to secrecy.
And they didn't go anywhere.
They didn't go anywhere. And people even in the neighborhood would be like, oh, I had no idea there was a Mrs. Rochester. Nobody knew. And I think he wanted to keep it that way.
Makes sense because he thought he could marry Jane and nobody would know.
Yeah, totally.
All those strangers came.
And what we find out is, I don't think you covered this. Correct me if I'm wrong. Because you go, how in the world did they find out? It's not like social media was a thing. There weren't even phones. It just so happens that Jane, you know, of course, she has her uncle, John Eyre, mm-hmm. right? And a letter had been sent to him from her talking about how she was going to be married to this Mr. Rochester. And it so happens that Mr. Eyre worked with Mr. Mason. And he's like, oh, I know that Mr. Mason knows somebody named Rochester. So he brought it up. Mr. Mason was like, oh, really? Mr. Rochester is getting married. Did you talk about this?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
What chapter was this in?
I think this was, maybe I didn't talk about it.
It's probably me.
For some reason, I thought it was in the next chapter, but maybe not. It was probably in my chapter and I missed talking about it. I'm sorry. It was. Mr. Mason and Mr. Briggs are like, yeah, we felt like we needed to come and save you from marrying Mr. Rochester because he's already married. Your uncle, Mr. Eyre, was very concerned about this as well. And she also finds out that her uncle is on his deathbed too. So yeah, that was totally my chapter. And I, for some reason I had it in my mind, it was in the next chapter. That's why I didn't talk about it. But it was definitely mine.
Which is interesting because when I was Googling the 30,000 pounds and I was trying to figure out how much money it was, mm-hmm. I stumbled across a spoiler.
That's okay.
I was like, oh, whoops. It's amazing. Like how easy that happened. Because anyways, so that's why I texted my husband. Yeah. It's like, can you figure out how much this money would be now? I just wanted an idea of like, okay, 30,000 pounds. Was that worth? Obviously, his dad and his brother thought it was worth that much money to.
Yeah. Remember when we talked about Pride and Prejudice? And we talked about Mr. Darcy and Mr. Bingley. Mr. Darcy was worth $10,000 a year.
That's a lot.
And it was a lot because if you think, I mean, that's over $1 million a year.
Yeah.
Right? Like something like 1.5. And especially for somebody who's not nobility, that's plenty of money. And even Mr. Bingley was something like 500,000, something, you know, 700,000, the equivalent of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they were very wealthy. That's plenty of money.
I'm excited to finish this. Two more
episodes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It's a long book. Love it, though.
I know. Page. I told Sydney today, I was like, you should read this book.
Totally.
Maybe
everybody when should read it or listen to it, whatever.
I was explaining to David today why I asked him to look it up. And I seriously gave him like a 30-second rundown of the book. So it was kind of funny. I was like,
here's... That's impressive. If you could do
that. I'm like, oh, now you don't have to listen to our episodes. And he's like, well, I already listened to the first one. I'm like, okay.
Good.
Anyways,
keep listening.
Next week, we're doing chapters 28 through 33. And it'll be episode 5.
Okay. So these are going to be more long chapters because this is another just like 6 chapters, 110 pages. That's impressive.
It's about the same. And then the last one is going to be less chapters, but I usually try to kind of leave us to do less at the on the last one because we talk about like other stuff. Okay, so the book I'm working on, which I haven't read very much of, is called Transforming the Difficult Child. That's what it's called. I got to look and see.
So this is nonfiction.
My niece's husband told me about it. He's a counselor, a licensed professional counselor. And I was asking him about a couple of other parenting kind of theories or ideas. And he's like, hey, you should read this. And his therapist told him about it. But it's called Transforming the Difficult Child. It's very similar to, what is that? Dr. Becky Bailey that teaches her book is called Easy to Love, Hard to Discipline. That's what it's called. So it's very similar to that. Here we go. By Jennifer. Okay. So that one is Dr. Becky Bailey. This one is Transforming the Difficult Child by Jennifer Easley. So interesting. The only thing I've learned so far is that, and it's very similar to what Becky Bailey teaches, is that you're supposed to give them these video moments. So you say things that you notice, but you're not judging them at all, like good or bad. So you're like, oh, you're building that Lego airplane with yellow and purple. Looks like you're working really hard on it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell them that you're noticing them, but you're not judging what they're doing. And so they said, if you try this, they're going to look at you funny, or they're going to be like, what are you doing? So the other day I said to Presley, oh, it looks like you're really enjoying holding Luna. That's our new little cat. We call her Baby Kitty. Luna. And she looks like she's comfortable in your arms. And she looked at me and she goes, you said that like you're mad at me. That's I totally did not say that like I was mad at you.
Sorry, you can't win. I hope that you know that. Oh my gosh.
What's funny is she did exactly what the book said she was going to do. That she was going to be like, what is going on here?
Wow.
And then today we went to see a high school production of Mamma Mia, and she was really, really, really good, which is the first time we've ever taken her to anything like this. And she sat through something without, I didn't have to tell her one time to sit down, stop moving, whatever. I think she might be getting sick. That has to be the explanation.
Why is it that with some kids, the easiest time is when they're sick?
Oh, yeah.
Horrible.
So we got home and I was saying to her, I'm like, you are so good today. And David's like, you're not supposed to say that. And I was like, I know, but I have to.
Sometimes you can't help it.
I was so proud of her. And I told him, I want her to do it again next time.
Yeah, seriously. Seriously, though. Jeez.
Anyways, it was a good day.
I'm so glad.
We always said with Katie, because she was our hardest kid before, this child has broken heart by 10 times. Out of the water. But Katie was the child that gave us the most heartache and the most joy, because she was so hard, but so motivated and happy and exciting. And she just had more of a,
many good and positive traits. Yeah.
But she was also the hardest. So yeah, that's what the difficult children do for you. They're like, you love them and you're so frustrated with them. So
yeah.
Anyways, you have something to share, right? A read book.
I do, legitimately. So I started reading a book to my kids just for fun. It has nothing to do with our school curriculum. I was just like, you know what, you guys, I'm worn out. We just need to read for fun. And so we started this book yesterday and I wanted to read to them again today. And then I wasn't able to, but it's super simple. It's The Wild Robot. I'm sure most people have heard of it because they're making a movie from it. So it's by Peter Brown. And basically it just like I said, we read the first 30 pages, which went really fast because, well, and there are, to be fair, there's also illustrations. But basically it's just this ship goes down in the sea and all these boxes come off the ship. A lot of the boxes are lost. A bunch of the other boxes crash and everything on the inside is destroyed. This one box survives. These little curious otters reach in and turn it and hit a button. And this robot basically comes alive, breaks out of the box. And it's able to adapt and like learn things quickly and speak and all this stuff. And so the robot realizes she's on an island. It is a she. And so, yeah, she's just going to have all kinds of adventures. It says she has no idea how she got to this island or what her purpose is, but she knows she needs to survive. After battling a fierce storm and escaping a vicious bear attack, she realizes that her only hope for survival is to adapt to her surroundings and learn from the island's unwelcoming animal inhabitants. She slowly befriends the animals. The island starts to feel like home until one day the robot's mysterious past comes back to haunt her. So I think it's going to be exciting. And the first 30 pages were really fun. Is it totally like below Matt's reading level? Yes. And probably even Ridley's. But sometimes I think you just need brain candy.
Yes.
So it's just sometimes, and it's about like rekindling that love of fun books. So
yeah.
That's what we're doing right now.
The key to kids wanting to read on their own anyways.
Yes. And it's not like it's trashy or something. It's totally good. It's well written. It's fun. It has a good pace and everything. Is it the most sophisticated language? No, but it's totally good. It's totally decent.
I've heard that book recommended a few times, and I think I've even bought it for kids for birthday presents before.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm.
But I found this Instagram account for kids literature. It's called... So we can find it. But it suggested picking at I thought this was really cool. At the beginning of the year, picking 12 chapter books that you're going to read to your kids. And just like one a month, making sure that you read to them. And it's called Dr. Billen, B-I-L-L-E-N, _ The Reading Professor. And every month she shares like a list of books and then... But I just thought that was a really good idea to just... And I could do that with Presley, is just decide one chapter book a month.
Yeah. And you could go from there and do more. But even if you just stick to those, that's 12 books that you've read to your kid.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Right now we're reading... This is really interesting. I wanted to look up when this was written. I'm reading to her the Millie Molly Mandy storybook. Mm. I wanted to see when it was written because somebody was asking her the other day what books she... what her favorite book is. And she said that one. Like, sweet. Who would have thought? I think this was written in like the 60s, but I don't know. I'm going to look. So it's the Millie Molly Mandy storybook by Joyce Lancaster Brisley.
They were published over the period 1928 to 1967.
And that's what her favorite book is right now. That's awesome.
Cute. That is awesome. I love it.
You know what? It's very similar to what we just read. It reminds me a lot of the Moffitts. There we go.
Oh, cute.
So it's a lot like that.
Okay.
We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss Jane Eyre, chapters 28 through 33. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.